This is an audio replay of the panel, How to Apologize Like a Feminist at WISCON 38. If you are interested in attending WISCON, please go to the site wiscon.info. That's wiscon.info.
Five geeks, five opinions, one podcast. Nerdgasm Noir Network, where we do nerd shit.
Welcome everybody. It is 8:30 and I would like to begin our panel this morning. It's nice to see you all here so early in the morning, and a nice WISCON welcome to you all. First of all, I would like to offer my thanks to the organizers who have set the panel up and who have done such a good job so far. It's been wonderful. My name is Trish. I come from 1,800 miles away from here, northern Alberta, and this is my first WISCON, and I said, put me on any panel. I am good at moderating, I just don't, am not that good at content. And so this is where I ended up. Is there anyone here who will, at this point, would like to express themselves about a topic or an aspect of Rape Culture 101 that they would like the panel to address?
I'm just always interested in intersectional issues and how that affects things.
So Rosemary is interested in intersectional issues and how they address. So how do class or race or ageism or ableism influence rape culture?
Sure.
And I asked a couple of people in the audience, well, actually they sat at my table at supper last night, about questions they were interested in hearing panel members, or that they thought it might be interested. What techniques have you found successful to deal with and combat rape culture in your life? And how does rape culture affect how you express your gender? Now that might take a little bit beyond Rape Culture 101, but we're mostly interested in just having a really good discussion here. So, this is the topic we were given, and we feel quite able to depart from it if our discussion takes us there. What is rape culture? Why is it important for us to understand and talk about it? How do we sometimes find ourselves upholding rape culture? And what can we do to stop? So I've asked each of our panelists to do a nice big introduction of themselves, why they want to be on this kind of panel or this topic, what kind of values inform or life events have informed why they are willing to be on this panel, and if they have a position on any of the questions to address that. So please help me welcome our first panelist, JP.
Hello. I'm JP Fairfield. I am one of the co-hosts for a podcast called Nerdgasm Noir Network.
Could you repeat that?
Nerdgasm Noir Network. So the reason why I wanted to be on this panel is I wanted to kind of give my viewpoint of my experiences and feelings about rape culture and how it affected my life and the people within my life. So it took me a very long time to kind of come into grips about how it has affected my life. I'm a survivor. So it just even thinking about talking about it, just getting to this point took so much work and so much looking into the mirror to even, I've been in denial for so long about it. And I'm hoping that just me having the strength to talk about it now gives someone else that strength.
Well, I thought maybe she'd go for 10 minutes. Allison.
Sure.
Sure. My name is Allison Moon. I'm an author and a sex educator. A lot of the sex education I do often is community-based, pleasure-based, and focused on adults and the way that we run our sex lives, which often has a lot of intersections with the way that we live in the world, which also means the way we live in rape culture. What I think rape culture is, and I didn't do a whole lot of Wikipedia-ing before this, but I think rape culture is a system that prizes the inevitability of sexual power in our society. And it's that inevitability, or it's from that inevitability which stems all of the... Yes?
Could you, like, slow down?
Cause I can try. I'm caffeinated right now. I will try.
Okay, yeah, I
totally understand.
A hard time hearing anyway.
So. Thank you, yes. So it's from that inevitability that I believe a lot of the kind of subtle and overt notions around how we talk about rape and power dynamics and sexuality stem. And it's all from that inevitability where we start to control the victim's behavior or the potential victim's behavior. And we try and control the narrative from that point of view rather than controlling, of course, the root of the issue, which is people who rape or sexually abuse or abuse power. So that's kind of my take on it, at least this morning.
Well, thank you, Allison. Jacqueline, they've left you approximately 20 minutes.
I can ramble on. My name is Jacqueline Peltman. First time I said this in public. I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. About 25, 30 years ago, wow, that was a long time ago, I was in at the University of Delaware. I was on a group called SOS, which is doesn't really stand for anything, Survivor Support for Sexual Abuse, Survivors of Sexual Offense. We never came up with a good... We liked SOS, but we didn't know it. Mm-hmm. But we did. So I spent a little time on the beeper. We had beepers back then instead of cell phones. But most of what I did was educational. Early on in my tenure, our programming in the dorms and fraternities was more about this is rape, don't do it. Didn't go over very well. So I developed some new programming that was more aimed at sexual communication and communication in relationships. And that was a little more successful. I also was on the radio. This is when date rape was becoming more talked about. Did a radio show, and a lot of the callers were confusing date rape with dating, which was really disturbing. Since then, I've moved here and got a degree and had a family. One of my main reasons for doing this now is that I have two teenagers, a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old, a boy and a girl. And this is a really crucial time for them, I think, mm-hmm. in just learning about how the world works and how to protect yourself and how to speak out against this kind of thing. Do you want me to talk some more?
Sure.
All right. For example, I took my daughter to a Zumba class with me, and there was a new instructor, and he played a song that he apologized that because it was not the clean version of the song because it had the B word in it, and he apologized for that word. But the song was Blurred Lines. And I tried to explain to my daughter that it's not the bad words, it's the meaning of that song. And I don't know if I got through to her, but I find that a lot in the stuff that I'm listening to. And I mean, I write for children, so maybe that's why. But I've just found that even, you know, the music these days is just full of such an objectification. And, you know, there's a song that I'll just love, and then I'll listen to the words and be like, I can't listen to this. So I started to listen to music in other languages because I can't hear the terrible stuff. You know, I don't know. It's all about what the man is going to do to the woman, you know, and what her body parts are like. So that's one thing that I think is really pervasive and insidious. And another thing, I'm going to bring this up. I have a friend, Facebook friend, who talks a lot about rape culture, and But she's constantly peppering her language with F-bombs. And I would like to propose that we get rid of that word. Not because it's a bad word, because when you say children's word, F-U, you're not saying, I wish you to have mutually pleasurable consensual sex, are you? It's the word conflates sex with anger and violence. And by using that word, we're keeping those issues together, and they should be separate. And so I would like to propose that we work on getting rid of that word. That's what I want to say.
Thank you. I'm going to ask JP to respond to everything she's heard.
Everything.
Whoa.
Right, everything. Actually, going back on what you was mentioning about the songs and lyrics, so that kind of brung up a time where I was listening to a song that, because I'm an 80s kid, so it was the New Jack Swing and all that type of music. And it was this one song, I forget the band name, but it was called Just Can't Handle It. And when I was listening to the lyrics, and it's about a guy, and he said, I'm only 16, and she was 25. I was like, wait, whoa, I don't remember this, you know, reacting to these lyrics when I was younger. Before, I was like, oh, okay. And then when I listened to the lyrics, it's, this boy was basically, you know, statutory rape. And it was, and the fact that it was just glossed over so easily, it just, it makes you think when you go back to these songs that you love so much, like, oh my God, is this just being buried into my subconscious and I'm just not realizing, I'm not understanding? And you have these teenagers that are growing up with these music, and they're taking in all this information, and they're not really understanding it.
Yeah, I think that that actually is a nice kind of segue into the notion of intersectionality, right? That when we talk about rape, it's so often this idea of it's like straight man, cis man on, you know, straight cis woman or queer cis woman. Mm-hmm. But there's not a whole lot of conversation about any sort of other gender identities there. And I think that when you talk about it, it's actually really important to realize that the rape culture affects the way that genders of the victims respond a lot of ways. And when you're talking about boys, mm-hmm. you know, like, it's this assumption that you should be grateful. Like, oh, I wish my teacher came on to me when I was in high school. So the support system is very skewed in that perspective, mm-hmm. that because boys are supposed to be these hypersexual beings, that they should be grateful for any sexual attention they receive from an older, wiser woman, right? Which I think is a narrative that really pervades into these ideas of how masculine people are supposed to be in the world at all around sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to respond to everything else you heard, Allison?
Everything else I heard. Well, again, as a sex educator, I tend to talk to college kids as well, and one of the things I've noticed, and I can't say if this is a new phenomenon or not, because I haven't been doing this for, you know, 20 years, but, you know, there is this prevailing myth, and I think it comes from pop culture, I think it comes from the way we treat sexuality and gender in our society, is that nice guys don't get laid. And I think that this is a really weird problem, and I think most young men, again, cis, straight in this scenario, they get that that's not true, and they get that that's a myth, but at the same time, they don't know what else to do. They don't know how else to be. And this, I think, I mean, this is old school, this pressure, and, you know, I think back in the 50s, it was like the, if she says no, just give her a little bit more pressure until she says yes. Mm-hmm. Because she's supposed to say no. That's part of the mating game, right? Luckily, I think we're moving out of that narrative, but it doesn't. We're not replacing it with anything else around, like, the empowered, enthusiastic consensus, you know? We're not talking about the empowerment. And that's because, on the flip side for women, we're running into this issue of still having to play the virgin and the whore, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and that's has a lot of intersections with race around the way that we're supposed to be sexual and sexualized, and at the same time virginal and virtuous and, you know, clean until whatever. So I think that that becomes, the power play is no different. It's just, I think, more subtle and more kind of, I guess, more nuanced as we start talking more about sexuality in society. But again, like for me, what so much of my job is just letting people know that they have every right to their voice and they have every right to pleasure and that they have every right to speak up for themselves and be their own advocate, which of course is one of the hardest things to do in bed and elsewhere. Women especially, but everyone, doesn't really get empowered to speak on their own behalf around things that make them feel good, physically especially. There's still a lot of shame and stigma around just pleasure, period, let alone pleasure, sexual pleasure before marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I actually want to jump in something that you mentioned, especially about intersection with race. I know for me, being a Black woman, Black women are seen as unrapeable because we are always the Jezebel, we are always available for sex for anybody because we are animalistic, we are highly sexual. And so a lot of issues that I had and other women who are, I'm just gonna speak in terms of my race, that it's an expectation that, oh, if this guy comes up to you, one, Black women are undateable, so you know you should be glad that we want to have sex with you. And if we say no, oh, you're just you can't say no, you're supposed to be available to have sex with me at all times. So it's a really hard space to navigate because you're not being seen as a fully realized woman. You're seen as a object and a tool that is used for a man's pleasure, just on the basis of the fact that I am female and Black. And so when you get into talking about rape culture, and it's very different paths that a white woman will have to navigate versus a Black woman or maybe Asian or something, because we all have different stereotypes that are put upon us and that society reacts to us depending on what stereotype they gave us. So for, and I think it was something else I wanted to comment on. I forgot. I don't know.
I had something that Allison was talking about in that on consent, and I recently got back in touch with this group that I was working with, and right now a lot of their educational programming is about consent, and it's giving students scripts that they can use, men and women, and this is how you ask for consent without saying, would you like, blah, 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 blah. And learning that an enthusiastic yes is what you're looking for. And I found that really hopeful. I met my husband in this group, and we did one of these programs. And the way the program works is we would separate the men from the women, and the women would say, what have you always wanted to know from men? And the other way around, and then we would do written responses, they come back and get their questions answered that they couldn't directly ask. But my husband and I went on our first date after one of these programs, and we sort of sat at the restaurant and said, well, should we practice what we preach? You know, what are your expectations of this relationship? And it sounded really, we knew what we were doing because, you know, we had training in it and everything, but it was sort of like, it sounded really like a script. But I think that they're working in the right direction, in that we need to give our kids, especially, the language that they need to navigate this. And I'm really pleased to see that they're doing that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I find incredibly frustrating when I talk to young folks, is that there is this notion, and I think we all get it from our parents who get it from their parents. I don't think that this is, again, a new phenomenon, but there's this notion that sex is supposed to be organic, right? It's supposed to happen, you're just supposed to know, you know, like, and that to me is so irritating because I feel like the best sex most people ever have is the stuff that you negotiate, right? And I think that, you know, again, like, unless we know how to talk about this stuff, like, you can't really do it right. And that can be anything from, like, hey, like, just so you know, this is a no zone for me, or I'm a survivor, I don't know how emotionally I might react in this situation, to, like, can you move your finger a quarter inch to the left and then press down a little bit? Like, and that's all part of the same scale of being able to, again, advocate for yourself. And again, because there's so much shame not only attached to sex and pleasure, but also attached to being a victim of violence and all this other stuff, like anywhere on that spectrum of being able to speak up for yourself and advocate for yourself can be fraught with a lot of fear and frustration, particularly because of, you know, again, notions of virtue, like of women being, or people who experience sexual violence as being like damaged goods or whatever. And so being able to speak up for yourself, especially when there's somebody that you really like, and you really want to have a good time with them, and then being able to speak up then and risk, you know, the emotional intimacy you give somebody actually, you know, derailing what could be have been a nice time if you had just kept your mouth shut, right? And so I think that often ends up in this awkward space of not knowing how to speak up for oneself when it comes to both what you want and what you fear. But I mean, the negotiation stuff, I mean, something that I give people all the time is the yes, no, maybe list, which is just like three blank columns, and it's designed to be done with a partner or a potential partner, and it's designed to be done outside of the bedroom, so that dinner before possibly the sexy time might happen, where you kind of write down a list in the yes, no, maybe column, things that you might want to do with that person. And again, it's not a contract. It is more of a opportunity to figure out where the Venn diagram is, you know? And you can do it with kink. It happens all the time with kink where you're like, I do not want to try that, but maybe if I was with the right person, that would be interesting. But it also can just be like, you know what, I'm at a place now where even kissing is a little bit intense for me, so maybe kissing is the only thing in my maybe column and everything else is in the no. And, you know, if we get to know each other better and we like each other better, like, stuff might move from the no to the maybe or from the maybe to the yes. But this is actually a really fun thing to do. It's this notion that, like, it once you get rid of the idea that you're just supposed to fall into bed knowing everything about the other person's body, even though that never actually happens, once you get rid of that, it can actually, there's a lot of room.
The movies lie.
I know, like, Hollywood's lying to me. What do you mean? Yeah, and so I think once you get out of that framework, and into, like, how it can actually be play, it can be foreplay. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, we're assuming that we're all excited about what might be happening. Like, having dinner where you're kind of talking about the sexy things that you might want to try, like, is actually a really nice way of getting the juices flowing. And at the same time, establishing the consent conversation early on, mm-hmm. Which allows for a lot larger range. One of the things, and this is where rape culture becomes incredibly hard to talk about and pervasive, because it is such an incredibly diverse scale of stuff, right? It can be anything from, like, sex that you kind of regret the next day to, like, the story of the dude in the alley, right? There's so much in between, and that's where it's really hard to pin down, and that kind of speaks to the question of, you know, how do we sometimes find ourselves upholding rape culture, is that it's so nebulous in some ways, and sometimes it's, you know, your friend who realized that maybe he didn't get full consent in college and now 15 years later is freaking out about it, and you have to figure out how to be a good friend to that person, right? And that's the really challenging stuff when you start realizing that this is, it's not, again, the story of the guy in the alley. It's far more intricate than that.
It also can affect how we look at media. So learning more and more about rape culture, someone brought up the fact that in a lot of movies and TVs, you don't really get to see a woman experiencing a orgasm. Like, there is no close up on her face. You don't see her enjoying it. It's, I think there was, I can't remember, the documentary.
This film is not yet rated.
Oh, thank you.
Could you repeat that for the people in the back?
This film is not yet rated.
This film is not yet rated.
This film is not yet rated?
So they had a segment on the differences between a movie showing a man having an orgasm and a woman having an orgasm. And a lot of times they rate a woman having an orgasm as rated R or higher, or they'll try to take the whole scene out. And if it's a man, then it'll be NC-17 or it'll be a lower rating. So even how we see there's a difference in how we see genders enjoying sex. Women are not allowed to enjoy sex. Men are allowed. We are just the purveyors of man's enjoyment, which is unfair because we're all human beings and everyone likes sex. At some point in time, they're going to want to have it. So it's important also that we try to be critical and kind of look at what is around us and be aware of what is the messages that is showing to us, because rape culture from movies, TV, music, print, media, it's everywhere, and it's so insidious because something that seems so very simple, when you break it down, you realize, oh my God, this is what they're telling us, how we should see pleasure, how we should see men, how we should see women. And it's very, sometimes it gets tiring and you need to have that support group around you. So when it gets to that point that you just don't say, you don't give up and just say, oh, forget it, I'm just going to stick my head in sand and just let the chips fall where they may. So I don't know.
I want to extend on what you're talking about, the media, music, and movies, but I think also the news and politics is really getting, is it just me or is it just getting a little more divisive than it has been? Maybe we're talking about it more.
Mm-hmm. Because our
uteruses
are magical.
That's right.
Yeah. We can shut everything down.
I think it's because there's this one movement, you know, on one side that's trying to get things to be more open and more understood, like, let's look at it. And then the side that doesn't like that is like fighting back even harder. So then you have these like,
In Susan Bluey's book, is you can't have a backlash without a frontlash.
Yeah.
And feminism has created this frontlash that people are responding to with fear and violence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And legislation.
Yeah. So I worry about my kids watching that stuff and you know thinking that what these people are saying is actually true. And I try and educate them, but you know parents can only do so much.
We've got a question in the back.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
So we've got a question in the back.
I have a comment on women being kind of objects for, like, men. I've noticed, like, a lot of sexualization of lesbian couples. Mm. And men just seem to more, like, enjoy watching them, which bothers me a lot because there have been people who approach me like that, and women wouldn't have to say.
Well, I think that there's an assumption that everything a woman does in society is for a man's pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're speaking in really broad terms here, plurals, not singulars. I think that because of that, that if you are within the eyesight of a man who is turned on by that kind of thing, all of a sudden you are part of that scene that he's creating in his head about how everything's about himself. And absolutely, like as a queer woman, I've experienced that myself. But again, it's this notion that, you know, there's no such thing as a sexual pleasure without a man present, even either real or implied, right? That myth is so pervasive, because how can you possibly have great sex without a penis involved? How is that even possible? which is, I mean, you know, and again, like I think that against also has a lot to do with the way that we treat men to understand sexual pleasure, right? Like it's either all about the dick or it's not. And so when you remove the dick from the scenario, there is actually a lot of mystery there. And again, like from my perspective, I often have to find myself like giving a little bit more empathy than I normally would, again, as a queer woman, because I have to remember that like we all learn this stuff or don't learn this stuff from somewhere. And so a lot of these guys who don't understand how sex can happen without a penis, like I have to have empathy for them and for their girlfriends and potential wives. Because of course, like there's got to be, we have to talk more about like the various ways pleasure can be experienced by people, whether or not we're even talking about genital stimulation, right? We have to talk about how, why people might connect in various ways that don't involve direct stimulation on an erect penis. So I think that that's a really important thing to acknowledge, that we oftentimes, like there's a, I think for a lot of guys, again, there's this mystery of like, wait, two women together? And all of a sudden, it just becomes like this really hard math problem. Like IKEA furniture without directions, right? And so I think that that often is, becomes part of the joy or pleasure for a lot of these guys, is that they're kind of, they have to insert themselves into the fantasy because they don't other, they otherwise don't understand how it works.
Two things, kind of like on the comment of like men like not understanding like how it works without like the penis involved. It seems, from what I've heard from like friends and everything, that guys don't seem to understand the concept of foreplay and pleasure before you get to the main part of it, I guess. So I feel like that might be a problem that is also involved, where I don't think they realize that sex doesn't always involve the demon. So even like if it's a guy and girl couple. And then my other thing is, I've noticed a lot kind of like in school, there's a lot of like rape jokes and everything, and this is a slightly different topic, but there's rape jokes and people just don't seem to understand that when you, like when the guys in my school just start talking about the girl, like even when they're having, like when they've been dating this girl for a while, like I've stood in like the lunch line before, I've listened in on some of the conversations that the guys have had. And even when it's their girlfriends, they objectify them so much. And I think that's also a big problem with like the rape culture and everything, because they don't even see their own girlfriend sometimes as, yeah, a person.
And the two women back that just asked those two questions, what's your name, the one that just spoke?
I'm Brittany.
Brittany. And?
Carlene.
Thank you, Brittany and Carlene. Would the panelists like to comment on what they've just heard?
I don't even know where to start. I know from my experience that, especially when in rape culture, there's this sense of that men had to perform this hyper masculine monster thing that to prove that, oh, I'm a man and blah, blah, blah. And it's this eagle eye, you know, view of just, I need to have sex to prove that I am a man. And it's, and not realizing that the amount of sex that you have does not equal your worth as a man. And it's, and just getting, especially boys that are going through puberty and they have hormones and they're getting all these images that this is how I prove I'm going to be an adult. I need to have lots of sex. I need to objectify women. I need to treat them a certain way in order to prove my worth. And that's another thing that we really need to tackle and break down. And it's gonna take pretty much a community to kind of combat this, especially with parents and teachers. And it's just, it needs to be a fight from all sides. You can't just say, oh, it's just the media. Mm-hmm. You can't just say it's one thing, because it's everywhere. I know in a lot of my relationships, what I have been trying to do is, if I am with someone and they get into the idea of objectifying me, or maybe somebody passing by, I don't know, or on TV or whatever, I speak up I was like, I don't like how you said that. I don't. That makes me feel uncomfortable. That makes me feel that you might see me that way, and if we're supposed to be in a loving, caring relationship, I want you to see more than my body parts and what my body parts can do for you. So I think just to have your own mini revolution with the people who are within your life and just talk to them candidly and openly and show them that you're not afraid to speak your mind and that you're not afraid to listen either could be such a big step that it can help change one person's mind. And that's all you need to start, is just that one person who understands, hey, this is messed up. I need to change my ways. And that is such an awesome thing to happen.
And even extending on that, I mean, you can call out someone who is upholding rape culture and affecting that person, but if you do that in front of other people, mm-hmm. other people will be empowered to also speak up. So I think we need to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I know. But you're modeling, you're not only, it's too early in the morning for this. you're not only speaking up against someone who is perpetrating, but you're modeling this behavior, and we need to model. Our kids learn from our behavior. We can tell them everything we want, but what they see is how they learn.
It's also, I mean, I think that there, especially, I mean, thinking back to school stuff, I mean, it often extends from a bullying mentality too, mm-hmm. where there's often, in my experience, like one kid who's actually kind of steering the ship and all of his or her friends go along with it, mm-hmm. Whether they want to or not, because of, you know, as humans, we're afraid of being, you know, excommunicated from our communities. I mean, when I was in middle school, there was a kid who was kind of renowned for sexually harassing and would, like, run around the schoolyard, like, bumping into girls, you know? And it happened to me, like, 2 times, and then I complained to my friends, like, oh, he does that to everybody, and I'm like, and nobody's said anything yet? And, like, and that, I mean, this can be, like, a nice way of kind of using one's privilege, too. Like, I felt comfortable and safe enough in my status to be able to go to the principal and be like, okay. And so I complained, and bless their hearts, this was a time in, you know, in the 90s where the people were really paying attention and really trying to nip this stuff in the bud. Mm-hmm. So I really, I mean, obviously have to be very grateful for the administration themselves, but oh my gosh, they didn't waste a second. I mean, the vice principal, like, ran over and grabbed the kid by his ear and threw him into the principal's office and scared the living daylights out of him enough that he never did it again. And actually, I think it got suspended and maybe I ended up leaving school completely. And then afterwards, I got a lot of flack from everybody for speaking up because, you know, I was my friend, blah, blah. But then I started getting people, both his friends and girls that he had harassed, mm-hmm. like, thanking me privately. Mm-hmm. And it was such a moment, like, as my, like, whatever, 7th grade self was like, oh, this is what activism is. And it was a really interesting moment of realizing that, like, oftentimes it's the ego and it's the need to belong. It's not necessarily, like, a, you know, a group mentality as much as it's one person that's kind of trying to look to their peers to get support. And when you remove that support, it actually kind of crumbles under its own weight, which can be really helpful and useful.
And it's important to remember, too, that sexual harassment and rape are not necessarily not about sex. They're about power. Mm-hmm. And sex is the tool that is used to exert that power. And we need to separate those things.
Yeah, and can we get rid of the saying, boys will be boys, because... Yes. No, they would not.
Right. All right, I'm going to start at the back. The person furthest back can speak first. Can you give us your name, too?
It's Rain. R-A-I-N, like the weather.
Okay.
I don't know if this only happened to me, but I feel like there might be a problem with... defining what sexual harassment is, because I ran into a situation where I was sexually harassed, but I didn't actually know that it was happening to for me until somebody said, do you realize that what it was? And maybe I get that it's personal, but I feel like I had never really run into what rape culture is before at that point, or what sexual harassment is, and that might be a problem in the future. If you don't know if it's happening, then you don't know how to stand up for yourself. Mm-hmm.
I mean, my simple answer is whenever you feel like you have to put up with something, that's harassment. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the sexual tones can be different based on a lot of different contexts. But yeah, I mean, like if you feel like you have to keep quiet and just sit still to survive something, odds are that's some sort of harassment.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's, if it's a sense, it's a feeling. And that's the problem with a lot of this stuff, because it is so nebulous that it's like, you know, convince a jury of that is a completely different thing. But that absolutely, that's the kind of time when you're like, okay, like I actually, like I have to figure out how I can be my own advocate here, whether it's in the present or in the future. But yeah, that's kind of my short answer.
Moving forward, it's Brittany?
I'm sorry. As a survivor myself,
we'll just wait until you're able to talk, Brittany. There's no hurry.
I've had numerous situations where, well, most people might not react as strongly as I would. I think it's still uncomfortable for some people. For example, I'm on the track team, and with the weather getting much hotter all the time, a lot of the guys like to like take their shorts off, or like not their shorts, their shirts off, and like try and get as comfortable as possible. And of course, them being the hormonal, horny people that they are at this age, they often like act like sexual or whatever, and they do stupid stuff. And I always try my hardest not to let it show that it really bothers me, but there have been numerous times when I've looked away or walked away, like when the situation starts to arise, and I've had people ask me, what, you can't handle this? Or like, what, this is a problem for you? Like, they don't understand that it might bother some people. And like, this has just started happening a lot more, where everybody is like trying to act as sexual as possible, either to get with the person that they like or to just try and like act cool. And for me, I get very uncomfortable, and it's actually pretty emotional for me. And as somebody who prides herself on being a confident person and able to speak out about whatever I want, I always find this topic to be the hardest for me, and I never know how to react about it. And I need a way to be able to tell them, just please don't do this, without, like, breaking down.
Would any of our panelists, can you think of a coping mechanism technique that Brittany can have a voice and some power in that situation?
I know for me, what I kind of do is I like to take deep breaths and just, I'm one of those people that I need a moment alone with myself to get myself calm. And just kind of, if I know the situation is going to come, because I pretty much have little scripts in my head for situations that make me uncomfortable, especially in terms of what happened to me. So when it gets to that situation, I'm sorry. I have a script in my head that I say over and over again. So if it ever comes up, I don't have to think too hard about what I need to do. I have something that I can hold on to say, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to set it up so I can cope and I don't have to over-explain. Like, it's point one, two, and three, and I'm gone. I don't want anyone to ask any more of it or any less. This is making me uncomfortable. I would prefer if you not do this around me. If you expect and care about me as a person, I really need you to do this. Just please do this for me so I can get through the day. And then I walk off, because that's about as much time as I can take before I start to break down. So I don't know if that will help you. It's sometimes it takes a long time to kind of figure out what the best coping mechanism for you will be, but just having one, just trying to have the space for yourself and carve that out so you have somewhere that you can, whether if that's a physical place you can go to or mentally, you know, something that you can think about and go over and over in your head so it can kind of center you.
So, I don't know. And there's nothing wrong with the way you feel. No. Your feelings are perfectly valid and admirable. What you were saying, going to a special place, I do that a lot. And it gets easier with time. It really does.
I just wanted to also comment that I work in an environment where no one is allowed to remove their shirts. I work in a treatment center for people who are going for treatment for drug and alcohol substance abuse. And as a institutional policy, the men aren't allowed to remove their shirts. And so that is another aspect. I mean, we assume that all of our clients and many of the staff are wounded. We assume that. And we assume that we need to be cautious. And so if you are willing to make an approach to the people who set policies and procedures, that is another way to begin to educate the larger system that we don't remove our shirts anywhere in public in this institution because it could be a problem for people, and we're sensitive to that. And so that could also be a way that you could be an activist. Okay, I'm moving forward. The fellow with the little red streak. And your first name is?
Mo. I know we've been talking a lot about consent issues sometimes in education for people. And I would encourage anyone who's interested, there is a consent and sex education panel this afternoon, which I'm really excited to be talking about.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Oh, I'm sorry. There is a consent in sex education for youth panel at 2:30 this afternoon, but I'm excited to be on it. I do sex education with maybe like the 14, 25-year-old age range. And one thing that's one area that I'm really spend a lot of time on. And one thing that we find is we have a lot of people who come into the direct services of our organization and say, there's something that's happening in my relationship that's strange, or I feel weird about this. And we'll describe very clearly the sexual assault. Sometimes these people have said, I have told these people about this, and they all said it was fine. One person told a counselor at Rain about their sexual assault, who said it wasn't rape, and I'm still mad about that. But it is something that I feel like, from as early as you can, talking with kids about personal boundaries and make them hug relatives they don't want to. Mm-hmm. If you're tickling them, they say, tickle me. And any sort of, from a really young age, not writing off any sort of like intrusion in the bodily space as just a game, whether that's, you know, they're teasing you because they like you. And I really believe that you can kind of help, you know, at a young age, kind of helping younger children for boundaries. But I think, you know, having those conversations, it's hard to have a conversation about like how you form a healthy relationship. I think it can be hard as a parent. Because, right, like your kids only want to listen to you to a certain extent. But yeah, and there are people who come in very clear about like what's happened. Like, I want support around being raped. But I feel like it really hurts my heart. People really don't know that it's an issue. I mean, and it's not just young girls coming in, like it's people of various genders coming in having confusion about relationship dynamics that turn out to just be you're kind of dating a predator and he's assaulting you. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. There's folks doing it, but that's absolutely it's changing. I think it just takes a lot of work to continue to change it.
Yeah, I love that's the conversation at that level of like, there's so, we always forget to talk about this, of like, there are people who regularly get touched in ways without their consent, without having any voice in it, and they're called children. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so yeah, like forcing somebody to hug or kiss a relative that they don't like, all of that stuff, it's so funny because it's kind of this blind spot for a lot of us around how we acknowledge, like, where when we start teaching those values, and we kind of, again, as especially in America, we kind of perceive children to be these non-sexual creatures up until this one point, at which everything flips. And it's like, and that, you know, we're disembodied otherwise, or, you know, our bodies are somehow neuter up until a certain point. And it's so interesting to talk about, like, well, no, actually, like, let's talk about, like, good touch, bad touch, pleasure, and all this stuff. And one of the things that I remember teaching about how to, like, recognize a child sexual predator is that they tend to find children who don't know the names of their body parts. Because those are obvious, those tend to be kids who nobody talked to about sex. And so if they don't know how to name, like, their vulva or their penis or whatever, then odds are they won't have anybody in their lives that they can talk to at all about that stuff. And so that was a thing that I remember, like, by kind of being a really epiphany for me of just this, like, this kids, I mean, at the very young age, they need that stuff so badly, in so many ways, more than we can kind of just drill down at when they start to go through puberty. So thank you for that.
Moving forward, did I miss anyone behind Mo who had a question?
My 17-year-old daughter mentioned the other day that she thinks, at least in her high school situation, that rape culture is promoted mostly by the girls. Mm-hmm. She's dressed like a slut. Mm-hmm. She's got another boyfriend. She must be a whore. Those kinds of comments objectify and diminish a person to a point where they become only that, and the people she hears say it are the girls. So my question for the panel would be, what do we say to our girls? How do we, you know, do you perceive this as an issue elsewhere, or is this just isolated? Do you think that women perpetuate the rape culture just as much or more as men?
I believe just as much. Because we're getting the same images, so of course we're gonna perpetuate the same stereotypes and tropes, and I feel like it's the same thing as if we're, well, not exactly the same conversation that we need to have with men. With girls and women, we need to at least explain to them about rape culture and about how we shouldn't put these labels on other women, because whether they know it or not, they're putting this label on one girl, someone else is putting that label on them. So just showing that, you know, calling this girl a slut because of what she dressed, that feeds into victim blaming. And the first thing that happens when a woman gets raped, what was she wearing? Why was she walking down the street like that? Why was she switching? And it's so much picking apart about everything about that woman when we should be picking apart why she was attacked or raped. And so I know what I do when I am around young girls that might say, oh, she's so slutty, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, you're not going to call her slutty around me. You're not going to call anyone whores or all that. You're not doing that around me. Because no one is a whore. No one is a slut.
Unless they identify that way.
Right.
Well,
yeah, unless they...
The comment was, unless they identify that way.
But I'm not going to sit here and let you tear down another human being because of their gender or what they're wearing, or if they, maybe they enjoy sex. And a lot of times, especially thinking of a situation in high school, girls that would consider fads or sluts really wasn't. It was just that they just caught the bad end of the popularity stick. And that's it. It's just, they, it's just for some reason, somebody decided you are going to be this.
Okay, I'm moving forward, but I'm also taking it in terms of time. Was there anyone nearer the front who had a question? Because this man has had his hand up for a little while. Okay, I'll take your question, sir.
I had a question and also a commentary. The one with coping. I know my wife's triggers, and my job is to be an answering machine, which they trigger because I'm not emotionally involved with it. So I actually will explain it even if she's sitting next to me crying. My job is to explain it because she can talk to me about it, and I know her talking points, and so I'm willing to do that.
Do you mean to a third party?
To a third party.
Okay.
Because if she has to walk out, if they ask questions, I will explain it in terms that she's comfortable telling because she told me what to say, and I've done it even with her sitting next to me because she can't talk.
Did the people in the back hear that? Okay. Thank you, Dylan.
And the question I had, if you don't mind, is how do you think the perceived differences of how genders communicate impacts it? Because you have the subtle complexity of women versus the rather bluntness of men's communication, which has its own subtlety, but it's a much different one, related to this. Because since I got it confused, like my brother never knows what his wife is saying because she keeps saying, you should know what I'm thinking. And I'm like, no, I don't. If I knew what you were thinking, I would have done it. And I've seen that too, of there's that differences in communication methods. Some of them involve a lot more body language and other things that you need. You don't have training on the other gender side, for example. And so it's kind of an opaque, I have no clue. And it comes from both sides because a lot of women don't seem to know what guys are thinking, as a purely stereotypical, and it's much different communication modes. So I'm curious how you think that would contribute to this.
I'll start at the far end of the panel and I'll go this way. Jacqueline, could you address that first?
Thank you for your role in your relationship. I wish more people were like that. Yeah, it's a problem, you know, and I think you said, you know, men are blunt about it, but there's a lot that men are not communicating. Yeah, I think the perception is that women, the stereotype is that, you know, women are more open about their feelings. I don't know the answer, and I agree that we need to expand our range of communication. And be open to receiving that communication as well as communicating in a more honest way. Does that make any sense at all? No, it doesn't. All right.
Thanks, Jacqueline. And JP.
Yeah, I think is a issue is that our communication range is kind of shortened based on gender, which is kind of weird. And so I had an issue in my younger years in being in relationships, and the fact that I grew up with a very blunt mother, so I became kind of blunt in what I wanted, and when I, like, if someone did something I like or something I didn't like, I pretty much told them, like, very factually, this, no. So I had problems in relationships because the man I was involved with expected kind of this emotional breakdown, run around, and so they will always do the opposite of what I tell them because they thought that's what they were supposed to do. And I was so I would tell them, don't you you know, don't grab my arm. And they will keep doing it. I'm like, why? Oh, I thought you was playing, because, you know, women don't really tell you exactly what they want and stuff. I'm like, but I broke it down to you. Like, don't touch my arm, otherwise you might come back with a nub. So that's very, very factual. So it's pretty much about upbringing, because I was taught to be kind of blunt. And I'm not a person that talks a lot. If I pretty much have what I want to say, and then after that, it's kind of done for me. And so when in relationships and with men, if they have a different perspective of how I'm supposed to react to situations, I think that's a big problem, because we have these expectations of how a woman should react to a certain situation, how a man should react to certain situations. And it might be completely off base. And if we need to go into relationships as if we have no idea how human beings work, mm-hmm. and try to learn how that particular person may react. And the problem is, we don't want to talk honestly. We don't want to hear that something we are doing is wrong, or that people don't want to do the work. And I think that's kind of breakdown to it. They want it to be easy. They want this checklist to be, okay, blah, 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 blah. And it's not that simple. So,
My partner is also a sex educator. And one of his mottos is, be the change that you want to see in the bedroom. which I think, and this obviously works very well in relationships, right? But there is a lot of the role modeling. And I think that, again, something that I teach a lot is just like, if you want more communication in the bedroom, then start speaking up, right? Like, that's your job as a responsible sex-having person, to start using your words and to start being the person. Because what I find is that, like, when I'm the person who's either like, don't touch me here, or move a little bit to the left, then I automatically give my partner permission to speak up exactly the same way. But a lot of us, we get into the whole like sexual mimes thing, and then one of us is afraid of like breaking the seal, and then nobody's speaking up and nobody's asking for what they want. And this translates very clearly out of the bedroom as well. But I think it is this kind of just getting in the habit of just saying something, and whether it's like, honey, you're on my hair, or like, hey, like, I'm really not feeling this. Can we just pause, time out, and back it up? So I think that that's a very much of the, like, if you want to change something, you got to start role modeling it for your partners. And then I think that, you know, just as much as learning how to speak, it's really learning how to listen and teaching people to learn how to listen, not just to words, but energetically, really listening to how somebody's reacting and getting some sort of emotional empathy going. Because that, I find, is actually the thing that I noticed that so few, again, like, gendering like whoa here, but like so few young men are learning, is that like that sometimes, like, if she just like shrinks and freezes, that's probably not a good thing. You probably need to time it out and back it up. And then, like, for me, it's like this teaching people that, like, there's nothing wrong with timing out and backing up at all. And again, like, partners of survivors often learn this very clearly, because often we can stumble into triggers without even knowing it, and then it becomes like oh my god, I hurt you, I didn't want to hurt you, so we have to time it out and back it up. But what I find is so useful about that is that, like, if the moment cannot be regained, it probably wasn't a real moment to begin with, right? So if you're having a real sexy moment, odds are you can get that back, but first you're going to need to time out. I think that so many times we get caught in this spiral, or again, my partner calls it like the hamster wheel of death, where we just kind of get stuck in the hamster wheel, and then speech becomes farther and farther away the longer and longer we take. And then by the time we do have the courage to speak up, either it feels too late, or now we're going to say something that we should have said 20 minutes ago, and now our partner's going to freak out that we didn't say it 20 minutes ago, right? Like, why? I've been on your hair this entire time. You know, like, and again, like, in relationships where people are, like, on the same team, right, we're assuming a healthy, like, good relationship, it's very, it gets, it's, you start, it's all about shortening the turnaround time, right? So it's not so much that nothing bad will ever happen, you'll never step on a landmine. It's that the turnaround time can be shortened over time, where you learn that, like, hey, if I speak up right now about this thing that I want or need, like, my partner's going to be able to get it, and we're going to be able to get right back into it. And if it's that is what you're looking for in relationships, in friendships, in whatever, in allies, right, and finding people who can help you advocate for yourself, it's that, like, I might freak out about this, or this might trigger me, or whatever, and it's really about getting to a point where you can speak up in the moment as soon as you possibly can. Sometimes that will be a month later. Eventually, you're going to get that down to 4 seconds later, right? And that's just, that's an individual's own need for progress. But when you can get that turnaround time shortened, and then you can handle things in the moment, that's really where the beauty comes from. It's not that you're never going to have a bad experience again, it's that you're going to be able to learn how to advocate quicker. And you're going to learn how to handle the situation faster and how to be a good partner and ally as soon as you possibly can.
I only see Paige's hand up here. Is there someone who feels that they had their hand up before Paige that would like to
say? I don't know if before, but...
I'll take Paige's. And then the time now is 9:36, so we're kind of on the winding up stage. So.
I just wanted to put out there that one very big disappointment I got from my old male life was how the word rape was just thrown around very casual, and I never said anything, because I was walking out of my apartment one day just very early in my transition, and this guy is asking me for money, and he figured I was trans. And suddenly, I watched this watched myself become an object in this guy's eyes, and how he started to be very explicit about where he wanted to put his stuff in me. And I was just like, oh, that's what this word is about. And I just felt terrible that, you know, it's like we've got this, in the male world, the gravity of the word, or in the idea, just doesn't seem to be there. But when you're female, oh, that ramps things up. Yeah, it's something I'm wrestling with, because I went to a rock show and I'm wearing a short, you know, faux leather miniskirt, and I'm just trying to, like, touch this female sexuality I spent a chunk of my life trying to attain. But it's just like, okay, I'm playing with fire here. You know, what am I tempting? And I'm just, that was a very stressful night, but it was a great night. I felt like I was playing with fire, because there was all these extra connotations around female sexuality that I didn't feel like I completely knew what I was playing with. Mm-hmm. And just the ignorance of the life that I knew and how pervasive it is. And casual. It was shocking to learn and experience firsthand.
Thank you, Paige. And Rosemary, Sophie Girl.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to what we were talking about as far as, you know, slut shaming, especially like, you know, in high school with girls and stuff. And I think a thing that happens quite a bit is a girl who has been raped ends up getting the slut label, mm-hmm. which often then makes her more vulnerable to attacks in the future, because people think, oh, she's easy, she likes sex, mm-hmm. and then bam. And so I think that's, it can be a real cyclical issue. So that's just another issue with the whole sort of slut-shaming, victim-blaming mm-hmm. cycle.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll take Brittany, and then I'll take Lydia.
Okay, I have a couple things. I kind of want to go back to the clothes, and it was a little bit ago, but... because I've been a victim and everything, there are some things that I find completely cute that I would really like to wear, but then I feel if I wear that, because there's the whole, what are you wearing when this has happened to you? I feel if I wear that, people are going to be like, oh, then this obviously didn't happen to you, or it obviously wasn't that big a deal to you because now you're wearing these clothing. But I should be able to wear what I want and not have to worry about bad things ever happening to me.
Thank you, Brittany. Lydia.
I think it all starts, like, really, really young, and I know this whole panel has been about this, but I remember I was, you know, like, I grew up in the 60s, okay, 70s, and I remember when the first time... we had sex act in my elementary school, which started when we were like in fourth grade, and it was all about menstruation and all of that. And the girls, you know, went into one room and the boys went into the other room. And the whole discussion was at one point during the PTA meeting was about whether they should talk to the boys about was it okay to have a what's it called? Like to have to like ejaculate by accident or you know like that kind of thing. And the whole thing was there was no discussion about girls' orgasms. It was all about boys' orgasms. And it was okay for boys, you know. So, you know, the discussion never came up about how girls felt about interactions. You know, about relationships. It just, that was not in the mix at all. And when I had my first discussion with my mom, it was all about, well, you're going to be menstruating. Well, then no discussion was ever brought up about past menstruation, you know, about women growing up and having babies and menopause, you know, so.
Thank you, Lydia.
I'm interested in hearing from anyone who hasn't spoken yet.
So this has like more to do with a point made a while ago about like women or like girls like in high school calling out other girls just like boys or sluts. And I feel like, I think that stems more from the idea that like if our entire life is about gaining attention from men, then like we need to take out the competition. And that's certainly something that I think is more like subconscious, but that's something that I experience more is definitely like the pressure from friends to still like, to get more attention from boys, whether it's like, I had this friend who was really manipulative to me a while ago, and she would always like make fun of me for being a virgin, or like tell me to get laid, or like tell me to act more like one of my friends who had a boyfriend, or like who a lot of boys had a crush on, and that's like, we're not friends anymore, but that's even up to like my mom telling me a couple months ago to get a boyfriend, or my best friend telling me 3 days ago to get a boyfriend. And they don't understand when I get upset at this because they think that I'm upset that like I'm not in a relationship. But I'm like, you don't even realize, like you identify as feminist and you're saying this to me and you don't realize the connotations behind that. And like, it's not making me upset because like, oh, woe is me. Like I don't have a relationship right now. It's more like people that are so close to me that realize like issues that are important to me and to them and they're still perpetuating it. So how I go about talking about like what they're perpetuating, what is really like part of the problem. How do I talk to people that are really close to me about that?
I'll get each panel member to give about 30 seconds on that.
Jacqueline. Oh, wow. I've always been really terrible at stuff like that, but it sounds like you're already more than halfway there. Because you have a self-assurance, I can sense, in the way that you're talking about it. I think just talk about it the way you're talking about it here is great. You strike me as a very level-headed, confident person, and letting other people know that would be a great thing.
Thank you, Jacqueline. JP?
I can't help but to be a little bit snarky with some of my friends. So when that, I had that situation happen to me before, and I responded, I'm in a very committed relationship with myself, and I would consider poly relationships in a future date, but not at this time.
Yeah, my easy answer is keep doing what you're doing. Most people in high school are morons. No, I'm like, I mean that. Like, you know, you're probably just smarter than they are about a lot of this stuff. And I think that's really, that's a really strong place to be coming from. I don't want to mean like you're elitist or anything, but like, I survived high school because I'm like, wow, most of my friends are morons. I love them, but I'm right and they're not. Yeah, but I'm like, I called my mom out on slut shaming me once when I was in high school, and I'm like, and it, when I told her, I'm like, Mom, that's a really terrible metaphor that you just used, and I was a virgin at the time too, but I was just like, this is gross, and she didn't realize it because it was what her mom told her. It was the story that her mom told her, and her mom told her it involved borscht, you know, like it's a long old story in my family, and so having just called her out on that, she had a moment of like, oh my God. Oh, wow. And she didn't even see any of the dynamics at play there from, you know, 1840 around the stuff that she's been telling me. And I think sometimes if you have the words for it, if you have the ability to articulate that stuff, it's your job in a lot of ways to be the one who's like, Mom, that's fucked up.
Yeah.
You know? Excuse the use of the F-bomb there. But that's like, it's a problem. And I think that sometimes that stuff is so not on a lot of people's radars. Mm-hmm. And again, like that, and for me, around the competition stuff, I knew I hated it, but I didn't understand that it was anti-feminist until I understood what feminism was. And so that took after high school for me to get to a point where I actually was able to articulate what the problem was. So if you can be the friend to women, if you can be the one who's saying, don't slut shame her, she's awesome, or whatever, you can probably affect a lot of change on a very quick level amongst your friends and community. And I think you might actually be surprised at how much people are willing to listen in that case.
And a lot of times it could be that they're rejecting people before they reject them. Because in high school, there was one girl who was always saying, oh, I'm better friends with guys than I am with girls. And there was a situation that happened, and we actually got to talk to each other. And she always had issues with girls bullying her and calling her sluts and stuff like that. So sometimes it's that type of situation that they're trying to reject other women before they get rejected.
I would like to thank everyone for attending today and participating and listening and commenting. Can we give our panel members a round of applause? Thanks, everybody.
And speak up.